Hey, Danny, do you like chores? What's your favorite chore?
I love chores. When I was a kid, my chore around the house was to vacuum. I always wanted to go outside, actually, but my dad thought that if I were to like mow the lawn, that something like a piece of metal would like get flung into my legs or something. I don't know. And so regardless, I was destined for indoor chores, and vacuuming is my go-to. I love vacuums. I can take them apart, put them together. It's definitely something I enjoy. But yeah, that's a weird question. What's going on? Why are you asking me about chores?
So you remember this talk that you and I recorded for the NSF-CCHF yep. annual mm-hmm. meeting? So Rachel S. Hall, at Rachel S. Hall on Twitter, actually tweeted about that. And she said, I think y'all need to have a podcast. I'd listen to y'all while doing chores. Keep up the good work. So I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. What do you say? You want to give this podcasting a try?
Yeah, why not?
Hi, I'm LC, and I'm a storyteller. I'm a passionate chemist who loves to explore and tell stories about how chemistry can change the world.
And I'm Danny, and I'm LC's spirited chemistry co-host. I love to bring high energy and positivity to my chemistry, but also my life. Welcome to the Farm to Table Podcast.
We're two chemists working at the pharmaceutical company Merck in the U.S.,
also known as MSD, everywhere else in the world except Canada, the U.S., and its territories.
And this is a podcast where we'll tell you stories about the people and the science behind the papers published by our chemistry group.
Each week, we'll pick one to two papers that we recently published and introduce you to the key people behind it, and also ask them to give you a unique insight into the story behind it. LC, do you remember, I guess, March of 2019? It seems so long ago. For some reason, I vaguely remember this day. I was in Delaware, and I was on Twitter just checking out what was going on. And Nature Chemistry posted a tweet because they were celebrating their 10th year of being a publication. And in order to commemorate this big event, they invited 58 scientists to, I guess, give insight into what the future of chemistry holds. And of these, 58 scientists, I had some friends in there, some former colleagues. But, I guess this day also resonates with what I like to think of as the shot heard around the industrial world. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so maybe this was the industrial concord. Conquered, if you will, in a sense. So actually, Allison Narayan, who was one of the scientists that was interviewed for this piece, actually tweeted it as well. And that's when I saw it, which was the day before. And I noticed immediately that there were no industrial scientists. So they asked 58 people. None of them were people that were working in industry. They were all academics. And basically were asked, where's the field going? What are you excited about? And I thought that was a big miss, and I wasn't the only one. Jake Janey, an old colleague of mine who's a scientist at BMS, tweeted about it. I tweeted about it, and I was like, hey, this is kind of a miss. To Nature Chemistry's credit, Stuart Cantrell, who's the chief editor, replied to the tweets, was like, hey, you guys are right. We rushed to get this out the door, and we neglected to get industry voices, so we want to be better going forward. And Stu and I actually know each other reasonably well. We had met a couple times at conferences. And so he basically wrote me, in the DMs and was like, hey, I realize I'm asking you to do some work, but if you want to write a comment piece about, the role that industrial scientists and industrial chemistry groups can have on defining the field going forward, we'd be happy to consider that for publication. So I told him, okay, well, let me think about that. Let me find colleagues that are willing to work on this together. And then you and I ended up writing this paper together that was published this summer, which, we decided to title Harder, Better, Faster with a nod to Daft Punk, if you will. And staying with the musical theme, actually, Stu, when he put the article on the cover of the August issue, used the byline, Stop, Collaborate, and Listen. So in theory, all of this sort of could be the answer to you know, a joke that starts with Vanilla Ice, Daft Punk, and Stu Cantrell walk into a bar.
I love that. And when you think about them walking into a bar, you naturally want to know, what are they going to drink? And Stu, you can, you know, he is a lover of gin, so that just kind of makes sense. Daft Punk, maybe something a little bit more fancy, maybe like a Last Word or something. But yeah. Yes. But what about Vanilla Ice? What do you think he would be sipping on?
Oh, I'm pretty sure Vanilla Ice is on Bud Light or Miller Lite out of
a
can.
Ooh, what about Zima?
Yeah, maybe.
But all kidding aside about what folks like to drink, when we started to think about, you know, what industry has done and how we go about influencing the field, we started to just reflect and think about, well, which industries have had a huge influence on the field of chemistry. And one example that immediately came to mind was Bell Labs. Bell Labs was put together around the 1920s, and they were basically tasked with, you know, overcoming the day-to-day engineering challenges of building a national communications network. But Bell Labs had within its doors some of the best scientists, engineers, mathematicians, physicists, who were also just tasked with solving problems that the world didn't even know existed yet. And, you know, they came up with solar cells and cell phones, and it was the 1940s, and there was no way that that was even, you know, a glimmer in people's minds yet. But nonetheless, they were, you know, exploring fundamental areas of science that were no joke going to influence the future of, I guess, the world. But when you think about the challenges that Bell Labs was facing and turn it back more inwards towards pharma, we're also facing a significant amount of challenges. It costs around $2.5 billion just to bring a drug to market. And this process takes over 10 years. But there are pressures, you know, to come up with drugs faster and make them better and make them be more successful, right? And that's kind of why we named our title of our comment, How We Did. But ultimately, when we thought about how we can make this process go along faster, you know, it really requires innovation. Innovation at every single level. Innovation from discovery to process chemistry to manufacturing to formulation to packaging to clinical trials, you name it. But ultimately, how do we get innovation, you know, into our field earlier? And, you know, what we thought about is we need to engage more with the scientific community. But, you know, industry, we tend to put up walls and we don't really share a lot about what's going on. But, you know, invariably, we just wanted to answer the question, you know, how do we make this interface between industry and industry and academia better? And we started to think, you know, how do we first have our own Bell Labs? Do we have our own Bell Labs within Merck? And one example of a type of chemistry that came to mind was photoredox catalysis. Photoredox catalysis has, you know, revolutionized the way that we think about constructing molecules. And we were curious, you know, how has this chemistry fared within our own chemistry groups? And what we did is we mined all of our electronic notebooks over the course of around 7 years. So from 2010 all the way to 2017. And what we looked for is how many photochemical reactions were being run. And what we saw was, you know, from around 2010 to around 2015, you were looking at, I don't know, maybe 40 reactions plus or minus a year, or 40 reactions plus or minus over the course of 2010 to 2015. But then what was crazy, so crazy, is that from 2015 to 2016, you see a 2,000% increase. So now people are running hundreds of photochemical reactions. And this number just continued to climb. And we wondered, what happened? What happened in 2015? Elsie, I believe you were in the catalysis group at around this time. Do you have any idea what happened here?
Yeah. I was head of the catalysis lab at the time, and we had started sort of figuring out photoredox catalysis sort of in that range, sort of 2013. We're trying to, you know, do chemistry there. But you know, the key thing for us that really spawned this is, I think, you know, you can imagine two things. One is there's some new technology or some new adoption that you know, made it easier for people to run these reactions. Or maybe it's just it was time and people didn't really know about photoredox yet. So those were kind of the two hypotheses that we had to discern.
Yeah, and to the latter one, I would say that, you know, Merck was no slouch in coming into the photochemical world. We had Dan DiRocco and Shane Kurska, amongst others, really coming up with new ways to apply photoredox catalysis to complicated drug-like scaffolds. And so as a result, we turned to technology. And what we realized was that in around 2014, we started a collaboration with Princeton to come up with the M1 photoreactor. And what was awesome about this reactor was that it allowed for the first time a very standardized and approachable way to run photochemical reactions. Because photochemistry and photoredox catalysis has been around for a while at this point. But what you saw was everyone kind of making up their own system, like, you know, a Kessel lamp or a CFL from Home Depot, and it was 5 inches away, and some were 8, and some used fans, and some didn't. And we just wanted to make it easy. Plug and play, you're off to the races. And so, you know, yeah.
Yeah. It's basically like a stir plate for photochemical reactions. And I think that that's something that sometimes we underestimate when new technologies are developed, and whether they're reactions or whether they're physical pieces of equipment, you need to have the user in mind. And I think what the M1 photoreactor did is it provided a benchtop instrument that was as easy to use as a stir plate, but that gave you reliable and high powered lights at the same distance from your reaction. So if you ran the reaction in your lab and I ran it in mine, we would get the same results. And I think that that was a critical advance and obviously led to, you know, orders of magnitude more adoption.
Yeah, no doubt. But that's our own example. Can you think of any other, I guess, industrial examples of this kind of like invention, inception, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that comes to mind, I think, is the introduction of fluorine and fluorinated formacophores in drugs, right? So the first fluorine in a drug was approved in 1950, and there was sort of a little boom of fluorination chemistry in the 50s when DAST became commercially available. But the trifluoromethyl group, which a lot of people associate with medicinal chemistry, you know, came much later. And in fact, if you do a search to try to find the first example of a trifluoromethylation of an aryl halide, it's actually a pretty old reaction. Kobayashi published this using a copper-based system sort of at the end of the 60s. But if you look at the number of examples in the literature of that reaction, it's basically singletons, you know, for decades. And it's not really until sort of the late 80s, early 90s, when the Rupert Prakash reagent comes out, that, you know, now trifluoromethylation chemistry really sees an uptick. And all of this is driven by the need to introduce these groups in pharmaceutically relevant or agrochemically relevant molecules. And so you have an order of magnitude bump there that's driven by that. And then in 2007, there's a really great perspective article written in Science by François Dietrich that basically talks about how important carbon-fluorine bonds are in pharmaceuticals. And that spawns a new era of innovation leading to some really critical advances. You can think of the palladium-catalyzed trifluoromethylation of aryl chlorides that Steve Buchwald published in Science with his coworkers, or the work that John Hartwick did on the trifluoromethylator reagent, which was a year later. And now you see another jump of another order of magnitude of the number of papers in this field. And so I think it's an example of where a need in industry for something that was really hard to put into a molecule really spawned a lot of innovation, but there wasn't like a tremendous amount of collaboration between the two. Like, can you think of another example where maybe there was more collaboration between the two that led to the advancements?
Yes. One that kind of comes to mind, one that I have a lot of interest in currently, is actually bicyclopentanes, also referred to as a BCP, not to be confused with banana cream pie, which is another story on another day. Yeah, I know.
You're making me hungry.
I digress. Regardless, bicyclopentanes, they had been, you know, first synthesized, you know, back in, you know, the 1960s by the Weiberg group. But then basically there was no application. They didn't know what to do with them. They were, you know, scientifically interesting. But it wasn't until 1996 when the Pellicari group kind of started to use them as a isosteer, basically as a phenyl ring replacement when they were pursuing these glutamate receptor antagonists. But again, you know, after that 1996 paper, there wasn't a whole lot more going on. However, Pfizer in around the 2000s, you know, showed that if you incorporate a bicyclopentane instead of a phenyl ring, they were able to get much more potent and also much more orally available biologically active compounds. And this was really, really awesome because it kind of, you know, solidified that a bicyclopentane is indeed a phenyl ring isosteer. However, you know, what came to be was that accessing these bicyclopentanes and actually derivatives of them was incredibly challenging. They actually had to pause their program because they didn't even have a way to scale this up. And what resulted was a really fantastic collaboration with the Behring Group, with Pfizer. And what they have, you know, what resulted was a strain release amination chemistry that was published in Science. And this really, you know, showed that, you know, in a very robust industrial academic collaboration, if it was maybe put into place sooner, would have maybe allowed this drug to, you know, reach higher within the development pipeline.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that really spawned an entire field of research into these BCPs, right? And I think both the Behring Lab, the Pfizer group, and a bunch of other groups around the world now are working collaboratively to sort of expand on the methodology and get to substituting these things with different functional groups. So I think that's a really good example of, you know, academia and industry coming together to really lead to a completely new field of research.
It sounds like we have, you know, really made the case that this is worthwhile, but I still sense some hesitation between the two groups.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, we thought about that in our article, and what we alluded to was sort of the divide that exists between the two camps, right? Between the industrial chemists and the academics. And I think industrial chemists will look at academics and say, well, you only care about funding and you only care about writing papers and we have to deliver something that's real. On the flip side of that coin, academics look at industry and say, well, you don't share any of your problems with anyone. You're not particularly interested in innovation and you're willing to settle for good enough. And I think, you know, we tried to exemplify this in our paper with a cartoon by Brendan Burkett, where he basically made an ivory tower and there's a scientist at the top that's screaming down at the scientist at the bottom. And, you know, they need to scream at each other because they don't actually connect. We actually made a version of this that didn't have any of the speech bubbles, and we put it out on Twitter and we asked people to, you know, write their own versions. And that was a lot of fun. And actually one of my favorite was one from David Palmer, where he relabeled the Department of Chemistry ivory tower with Big Pharma, literally in a magnificent facility. He put the industrial scientists at the top of that and the academic at the bottom. But I think the concept really spoke to, you know, there is a divide and we need to think about how to bridge it and overcome that because it's worth doing.
But why is it worth doing it? I mean, these are significant differences, I guess. So I guess what is Merck's approach to, I guess, overcoming this and making it worth it?
Yeah, I mean, I think for our company, we see this as a way of building new capabilities, both at Merck and at the university, right? It's an opportunity for us to learn new things. It's an opportunity for us to adopt new technologies, to develop new ones. For the universities, it's an opportunity to tap into the resourcing and get access to some of these wonderful facilities that we have. It obviously has tremendous benefits from a professional development standpoint. For the students and the postdocs involved, they can come and work in an industrial environment, you know, network with industrial scientists. For us, our Merck chemists get to mentor someone. It might be their first mentoring opportunity, and it's a way to develop a future recruiting pool of talent. And finally, I think it's an avenue for scientific curiosity. I think that both academic labs and industrial labs have specific areas of research that they work in, but often these collaborative projects lead both of those groups into new directions, and it's a really fun way to just follow the science and be curious. So to me, like, that's really why we do it. I mean, Danny, you've done a bunch of these. Is there one that kind of stands out to you as something that you want to share with
yeah,
us?
Yeah, I would love to. And I would say that Merck has been incredibly robust in engaging with our academic community. And honestly, Elsie, I think we could make an entire podcast of just Merck collaborations. But, you know, that's not the focus of today. And I think what we should do is maybe just give a quick overview of just a few that we have both personally been involved in most recently, just to kind of give a hint of what might be to come.
Sounds
and
good.
One story that I'd like to share with you is one with my friend and fellow colleague now, Professor Deepa Kalyani. And what I love about this story was that this collaboration kicked off in a kind of non-traditional way, if you will. Deepa and I were, you know, graduate students together when we were at the University of Michigan, and then she went on to become a professor. And Deepa and I had overlapped when we were at a Gordon Research Conference. And what she was really interested in is doing an industrial sabbatical. She was at a PUI, and she was doing a CH activation project, and she wanted to kind of make it more, you know, pharmaceutically relevant and get some, you know, potentially new results that she could then take to her group and that her undergraduates could then pursue. And so what we did was Deepa and I arranged for her to come to Merck for about a week, run some HTE or some high throughput experimentation, get some results, and then go back. But what happened was that Deepa loved it so much and fell in love with our people, our problems, all of our facilities. And ultimately, she decided to leave her tenure track job and come to work for Merck. And she's currently within our discovery group within a within the HTE labs. Actually, like, we share a lab. I see her on a daily basis, and she's always so impressive doing chemistry in a WebEx. I don't know. It's just like she's like dominating life. But long story short, this was a really great opportunity to, you know, show Deepa and also for her to then, you know, extend this network into St. Olaf and then bring on undergraduates as well. And, you know, the problem that we wanted to tackle was this CH activation, you know, to make these biarals. And we wanted to just kind of make it more pharmaceutically relevant. And so what we did was just try to use high throughput experimentation to arrive at a set of conditions that would ultimately allow this chemistry to use, you know, heteroaryl chlorides. We all know that, you know, pharma loves a heterocycle whenever possible. And we wanted to use base metal catalysis, so nickel ideally, because it's a sustainable source. But, you know, besides the chemistry, you know, what we were also able to do was Deepa was able to come on site. She used our facilities. We have these beautiful high throughput experimentation labs. We have glove boxes, like imagine 8 of them in a row with, you know, state-of-the-art equipment, pre-plated catalysts, ligands, you name it. And, you know, at the end of the day, we came up with a really nice method. This was published in the Journal of Organic Chemistry, and it, you know, gave Deepa exposure to pharma, but also gave one of her undergraduate students the same thing. And, you know, this is just my small story, I guess, of a PUI, but LC, I think you had a pretty big paper drop this year too, right?
Yeah. We recently published results from a collaboration that spawned from work that we did with Rob Britton, who's at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, in Vancouver. And this really spawned from a really interesting story. So we had identified nucleoside analog synthesis as a pervasive problem across the company, across medicinal chemistry, across process chemistry. We work with nucleoside analogs a lot, and they're always really challenging. And one day I was exchanging you know, pleasantries with Rob because he and I had collaborated together before, and he's like, hey, I have this hit on a reaction that I think might be useful to make nucleosides. And then he showed me the science, and I was like, whoa, this is amazing. Like, this could really have an impact. And so we decided to start a project together. And over the last few years, we've developed a new synthetic strategy to make nucleoside analogs and really be able to modify the ribose core any way that we want. And that ended up being, you know, even more fruitful than I ever imagined. And it's something that, you know, we're really proud of, because it was really something that, you know, I'm not sure we would have done on our own, either of us, if we didn't have sort of this this matching of a potential solution with a problem. Ultimately, the results were published this summer in a Science paper. So it was a really fruitful collaboration. And it's actually the second time that we collaborate with Rob on a project.
I think we've done a really good job. I like how we have given two nice examples, and hopefully people are interested maybe in collaborating with industry, but maybe they need a little bit more, you know, of a playbook. And what Elsie and I would encourage everyone to do is to engage. And what this means is you need to first, you know, start by, you know, finding someone to work with, right? And here your network matters. You need to leverage you know, your former alumni, whoever your advisor is, you know, who is in their network. When you go to conferences, even on Twitter, right? If you see like an industrial paper posted, just tweet back, nice paper. Have you thought about this? Just start the conversation. Of course, once you have, you know, a person that you want to work with, you need a problem. And I definitely do not, I wouldn't limit yourself to the problems that you want to work on. Projects are always changing, and we're always looking for new chemistry to try. And then last but not least, you know, when it comes to thinking of a proposal, this isn't a big deal. We just want a single page. You know, it's just like one ChemDraw scheme, a couple paragraphs, and that's about it. But I think besides this, though, there's a little bit more, I guess, behind the scenes that has to go on. Elsie, do you want to give a little bit of insight towards that?
Yeah, so I think whenever two companies and two entities like that come together to work on a project, you'll find that both companies and universities, frankly, will want to draft some sort of collaboration contract. That's pretty common, and that usually feels like it slows down the process. This stuff is important, though, right? It ensures things like liability when you have visiting scientists. It ensures things like IP and sets resource expectations so that everybody knows kind of what you're signing up for. The other thing that I think a lot of people underestimate is that a lot of these collaborations, and in fact, most of the ones that I've been involved with, and you too, Danny, I think, is, you know, you don't really need to have funding to do these things, right? A lot of times these are extensions of ongoing projects. And in the industrial setting, we can help support a variety of activities that can move a project a lot more quickly, both with our facilities and with our ability to purchase materials that might be, you know, a little too expensive for an academic lab, or even do some contract research work in addition to the work that we do ourselves. And so the training opportunities and the ability to share in industrial resources can often be enough to move a project forward. And so don't sort of stop yourself from collaborating. And here I'm talking to, you know, our industrial listeners as well. Like, if you know that there isn't money for you to collaborate, well, think of a creative way that you can still work with someone and make some ground on an important problem. I mean, we've leveraged this quite extensively at Merck. We've done a bunch of collaborations with a variety of schools that ultimately have led to some pretty important advances. And I would say that in the last, you know, 3-4 years, when Danny and I looked at some of the output, you know, we saw a number of really important papers in really good journals, you know, ranging from perspective pieces to new collaborative science, a lot of synthetic chemistry, and even some engineering developments in automation. So I think that these are all pieces of science that likely either group wouldn't have done by themselves, and ultimately were really important for the field.
I also like, you know, when you look back at all the collaborations that we have engaged in, there's just so much diversity. There's diversity in the professors, in the type of institution, and as you just mentioned, also in the type of research that we do. And I would say that, you know, please reach out to us and engage. There is not, you know, one school or, you know, that we would not want to work with. And so, you know, I think that this should, you know, hopefully inspire everyone to a call to action, right? To just pick up the phone, send an email, and just start to have this conversation and say, hey, this is what I'm working on. What, like, does this interest you? If not, what would? And, you know, let's just see what we can do together.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. Hey, Danny, what do you think? This podcast thing isn't so hard after all. You think we should keep doing this?
I don't see why not. I mean, it's pretty fun, actually. I like to talk to you and potentially to others.
Yeah. I mean, so what do you think we would talk about?
I think what we should talk about is, you know, we just kind of highlighted during this episode just some really interesting science. I think we should dig deeper. I think our listeners want to hear more about the science, maybe a little bit behind the scenes, if you will. What do you think?
Yeah. I like that. And actually, we could also bring on some guests. And so people could also learn about the people that are behind this science that they're reading about, maybe get a little bit more of a sense of the inception of the idea or how it was executed, and maybe some, you know, things that they don't know about the way that we work. And so it could be a really good way for people to meet some of our colleagues.
Oh, I love guests. I mean, that's like less talking for us then on a podcast. So
there you go. It gets easier and easier.
It keeps getting easier. Well, I think we have a plan. What do you say?
All right. I say we do it. So everyone stay tuned. We're going to try to do this again and we're going to have a fun ride together. Thanks for listening to the Farm to Table podcast. This would not have been possible without our fabulous producer, Mark Partridge, and listeners like you. Be sure to check our episode credits where you'll find more details about the show, as well as links to anything that we've discussed during the show.
If you find yourself craving even more info, you can find us both on Twitter. I am at Danny the Chemist, and LC can be found at Dr. LC Squared. But of course, our show also has a handle, and that is at Farm to Table Pod. Farm with a PH, in case you were wondering, where you'll find some behind the scenes action, future episodes and sneak peeks, and likely some random posts about chemistry, snacks, and whatever else.
Of course, we'd love to hear from you, so please interact with us on Twitter. Feel free to post any chemistry papers, Merck chemistry papers that you found particularly memorable and that maybe you want us to build an episode around.
So stay tuned, folks.
Because on the next episode of the Farm to Table podcast, I came up with a few questions here. I mean, obviously, this is a collection of papers that you guys have published over the last few years and actually has been cited a few times, and it's been cited as the Mallony-Fear reaction. So, Patrick, I'm curious, how does it feel to have a named reaction named after you?
Oh, that's pretty sweet. I'm a huge fan of name reactions in general. It's one of my favorite books is the Strategic Applications of Named Reactions. So yeah, it's an honor that people call it that. I don't know how many people call it that, but it's pretty cool.
Do you think that you're going to be able to make the book?
Laszlo said he would put us in volume 2.
Really?
Yeah.
We make sure to keep reminding him too.
Yeah, we remind him every day.
They have him on speed dial. Yeah. Hey, when's volume 2 coming out?